So welcome everyone to the new term, new Bina term, term three. Hopefully an exciting term with lots of different programs. This course we're doing today is going to be until end of August, and then we'll do another short series after that. And I've called the series The Leader in You, how to lift, inspire, and influence, how to lift, influence, and inspire others. Now, I just want to clarify the topic a little bit. This is, first of all, let me tell you what this topic isn't. It's not like Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Okay? Because that book has nothing to do with leadership. That book is rather about self-interest and how to get others to do what I want them to do. Right? This topic is about... Sure. There we are. Sorry. This topic is more about helping and inspiring others and how we utilize and access the leadership qualities which we all have within ourselves and we all possess in order to inspire and lead or help and guide others. Now, just before we continue, I wanted to just give a little bit of credit because actually this topic was inspired by reading a relatively recently published book by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks called Lessons in Leadership. It's an excellent, excellent book where he actually goes through all the weekly parshas of the year and draws lessons in leadership from them. So many concepts that I'm going to be expanding on or talking about come from that book. Now, this topic is... Today I want to just do two things. I want to sort of talk about the first concept of leadership, but really first go through a bit of an introduction. So let me just share with you the few principles that I've based this whole topic on. So the topic is based on a couple of principles and foundations. First of all, the first is that, as we've mentioned previously, the world is a world of giving and taking. Right? We've talked about this concept many times, that God designed the world, that everyone has things that others don't have. Materially, spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, whatever the case is, because he wanted a world of giving and receiving. He wanted a world of people to help and receive from others. It's called, in Hebrew, it's called the world of mashpia and makabel, giving and receiving. But an extension of that concept is that just like everyone is obligated, everyone has a responsibility to give and to receive, as we've talked about many times, everyone also has a responsibility to be a leader and a follower. In other words, what that means essentially is something we mentioned just at the end of last term, and that is that a human being doesn't have the luxury at all, just by the fabric of the way we created, to act alone, to exist alone, to be passive and not to worry about anything or anyone else. We don't have that luxury. Now, it's interesting that when God created the world, He created the human being as an individual, different to animals actually. Animals were created in pairs, whereas the human being was actually created individually. And the reason is because God wanted to emphasize the enormous power and enormous ability and the enormous importance to one individual. And we are taught in the Talmud that the reason that a human being was created as an individual, first Adam and then Eve came later, was to teach us that a person, a human being, is an entire universe. And when we help a person, it's like helping an entire universe. So it's really there to emphasize the power and the infinite potential within every single human being. However, very soon after Adam was created as an individual, we have the famous verse in the Torah that teaches us that Lo tov hayot Adam levado. It is not good for a man to be alone or to be lonely, depending on the translation. Because as much as the person was created as an individual to teach us the infinite potential and importance of an individual, at the same time, we are also taught that the very design of the human being is that we interact with others, we help each other, we support each other, we lift each other, we guide each other, we lead each other, and we follow each other. And therefore, the very essence of the human being is linked in with the concept of relationships and relating to other people, and that includes the concept of leadership as well. Sometimes that means accessing the leadership within ourselves, stepping up, speaking up, guiding, and showing leadership. Now, it's interesting, we've talked about many, many times the concept that every soul is guided by 10 powers, known as the 10 powers of the soul, the 3 intellectual, the 7 emotional. We've gone through that many times in different ways. But in the terms of this discussion, the 10th power of each soul, the final power, the climax, so to speak, of each neshama is an attribute we call malchut. Malchut can mean many things, but the word malchut in Hebrew means kingship, sovereignty, leadership. Because it's the power to inspire others. It's a power to lead. It's also the power to implement and the power to process. It has many, many different meanings, as we've talked about in previous sessions. But literally, the word malchut actually means to lead. Because part of the design of every human being and the various attributes that we have, the intellectual and emotional and so on, includes and in fact finalizes and concludes with this attribute called malchut, which is the power to lead. So that's the first principle that this discussion is based on. The second is just to define the word leadership before we talk about it. And that is that leadership is not authority. It's two different things. Now, there are leaders in certain contexts that have authority. Certain positions of leadership come with authority, right? But the word leadership doesn't mean to have authority over someone else. That's not the word leadership. Nor does it mean leading a large group of people. So when we talk about the importance and in context of this discussion of everyone being a leader, it doesn't mean that we need to lead the world. Not everyone can do that. Some people lead at different levels. But it does mean that we can have an impact sometimes on small groups of people. And it does mean that we need to understand that every single individual, every single person has a circle of influence. Every person has a circle of influence. There isn't a human being that doesn't have a circle of influence by definition of how we were created. So we all have some level of influence on some circle of people that we can have a positive effect on, that we can help, that we can point out. And leadership sometimes means stepping up and saying something that is difficult. To go back to a previous discussion, having a difficult conversation is part of leadership, but inspiring. It's all part of leadership. Doesn't mean we have authority over them, but we have a circle of influence. Now, that circle of influence, by the way, contracts and expands. It's not like we all have a circle of influence and that's our circle and that's it. And anything beyond that circle is not part of our influence. Every person's circle of influence contracts and expands depending on what we're doing and depending on what the influence is, right? So in Jewish sources, we have, for example, we learn about the impact of that comes out, that is a consequence of many things that we do or we engage in, right? So, for example, we can't change the world. So let's say if leadership is about inspiring someone else with moral values, so that might be limited to a small circle of influence because we're not going to change the world as much as we'd love to, and as much as often we try and change the whole world except for our circle of influence. That's what people naturally do. They always talk about how we can fix, you know, if America would choose this president and if this company would be run like this and this government would do this, then everything would be okay. And we forget about the people who we actually can help. So it's true, it might be in that context, our circle of influence might be small. But for example, spiritually, the Rambam Maimonides is very clear that on a spiritual level, we can actually change the whole world. Because part of Jewish thought is that when we do something valuable, when we do something good, we actually create a spiritual energy that has an unbelievable ripple effect that actually can have far-reaching effects. And the Rambam tells us that every person, before they act, before they behave, before they do something or don't do something, they have to view the world as a balanced scale, and everything I do can tip the scale. In other words, we can have an impact on the entire world. So it all depends what I'm doing and what I'm leading with and what is the impact or the influence or the inspiration that I want to be able to generate. That circle of influence contracts or expands. And sometimes we don't even know what the impact is. Sometimes, and this is also a part of stepping up and understanding that we have to live a life where we help and have a positive impact on others, because sometimes we don't know what we can do. Sometimes we do something thinking that had a very, very limited impact and then discover later that in fact, beyond the reach of our imagination, it had a positive impact on people beyond even that we know, right? So that's also worthwhile entertaining, that we actually don't know what our circle of influence is, and sometimes we just have to lead and generate positivity and try and generate a positive influence, not even knowing what the impact might be. So that's the second concept. Just to quote Rabbi Sacks, and I said I would quote from his book a little bit, but just one quote that I want to just read to you, when he talks about it in his introduction of how he came to the concept of leadership. He said, "Most of all, I began to understand that we are all called on to be leaders within our sphere of influence, be it the family, the community, at work among colleagues, or in play among teammates. What distinguishes a leader from a non-leader is not position or office or role, but rather a basic attitude to life." Right? And that's really, really important. In other words, leadership is not about authority, it's not about a position, but it is about an attitude, and we're going to develop that a little bit. "Others wait for something to happen. Leaders help make something happen." So it's about being proactive. It's about doing something, taking initiative and doing something proactively rather than being passive. "While others curse the darkness, a leader lights a light." So sometimes, again, it's not about authority. It's not about position or effort. It's not about instructing necessarily. But it is about having a mindset of inspiring others and lighting a light bulb or generating light, so that can be an influence and guidance and inspiration for other people. So that's the second principle. The third principle is that leadership, and this is an important thing, and this is why sometimes we're scared to take initiative sometimes, that leadership does not depend and has no link to apparent or obvious greatness. Now, this is an interesting thing to explore in the Chumash, in the stories of the Torah. Noah, and we'll talk about him a bit later again. Noah and the flood. Noah was a great man. How do we know Noah was a great man? Because he's one of the few people in the entire Torah that God refers to as a tzaddik, as a righteous person. So if you want to talk about greatness, Noah was a great man. Leadership, he was a very weak leader. And the Zohar criticizes his leadership, or lack of leadership. So greatness and leadership don't go together necessarily. On the other hand, Moses, for example, who's the ultimate leader, we call him Moshe Rabbeinu, someone who we can learn lessons of leadership for in a very great way, and we will over the next few weeks, even though he was a great leader, but we can take it in our context of leadership. Moses was would have been, as an obvious choice, he was a great man, but he would have been an obvious choice, a very weak leader. He was tongue-tied, he couldn't talk, he was insecure in taking up the leadership, he was scared, he was afraid. We talked about this when we talked about fear. And yet, he became the ultimate Jewish leader. If you take it a bit fast forward a bit in the stories of Tanakh, King David, but go before King David, the first king of the Jewish people, king obviously being an obvious position of leadership, was King Saul. Now, King Saul apparently had all the makings of a leader. The Tanakh refers to him, again, in unbelievable terms. The Tanakh refers to him as someone who's mishichmo ulamala mikol adam, which means he was head and shoulders above everyone else. And he was head and shoulders above everyone else. He was head and shoulders above everyone else in piety, in understanding, in intellect, in his emotions, everything. And yet he turned out to be a very weak leader. Because when he needed to take initiative, he needed to take initiative with the war of against Amalek and so on and so forth, many, many different things, he was weak, at least on his level, and God sent Samuel the prophet to criticize his leadership. And God said, Nichamtiv, whatever that means, God said, I've changed my mind. Whatever that means with God, that's a separate discussion. But I've changed my mind in terms of him being the leader, and he sent Samuel the prophet to appoint another leader, and he told him to go and appoint a king from the sons of Yishai, from the sons of Jesse, right? And the story goes, and this is, you see the contrast, that when he came to Yishai to choose a son, Yishai produced seven sons, a lineup of seven sons. And Shmuel had a look at each one. He says, no, this is not God's choice. God said, no, that's not what I mean. So he says to him, do you have any more? He says, not really. He says, no, you must have someone, because I mean, it's got to be a son. And then he pulls out King David. Why did he bring him out before? Because the whole story, King David was born and there was a whole slander behind him. He was like the black sheep of the family. King David was a little guy. He was a black sheep of the family. There was a libel. It wasn't true, but there was a libel against his father that he was born from a maidservant and an extramarital affair. Don't ask. He was always kept in the background. He wasn't the yichus of the family, put it that way. Right? And King David turned out to be the ultimate leader. The ultimate leader in his time, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, we say. His leadership continues. His leadership is eternal. And he started and initiated a dynasty. A dynasty which ultimately will culminate with the coming of Mashiach, because Mashiach is a descendant of King David. It has to be a descendant of King David. Only King David. Right? So, leadership therefore has nothing to do with greatness. Now, obviously, leaders have to grow in leadership. And obviously, leaders have to lead by example. That's true. But it's nothing to do with greatness in the context of talent. Leadership is something you grow into, and you grow with, and you access, and you discover within yourself. Each person, of course, has a different calling in terms of leadership, but each person can lead, each person can have an impact, each person can have an influence, and it shouldn't be measured by the natural talent or the natural skill that a person has. Going back to the concept of, again, you know, of leadership and authority. Because it's nothing to do with greatness, it doesn't have to be someone who's in a tremendous position of authority. There's a very fascinating story in the Talmud about Miriam. Miriam was Moses' sister, but not Miriam as she grew later to be the great prophetess. Miriam is a young little girl. And it was a tragic story, a story in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, where Pharaoh had decreed that all the boys should be thrown into the river. That was one of Pharaoh's decrees, that he would damage the Jewish nation by killing off the male-born children. So Amram, Miriam's father, and Moses' father, right, came home one day and shared this with his wife Yocheved, and they made a decision. Needs to be explored exactly the meaning of that decision, but they made a decision to separate and not to have any children, to abstain, not to have any children. And Amram, being in a position of power, in a position of authority, and a position of supposed leadership, because he was one of the great men that time in Egypt, people all followed suit. So it became an accepted thing. Well, it's not worth having children. If they're going to be thrown into the river, it's not worth having children. And who was the one to change that all? And who was the one to change that? At the time when Amram did that, him and Yocheved had not yet given birth to Moses, and wouldn't have given birth to Moses had that remained, that concept. So Miriam, a little girl, who was a little girl at the time, came to her father and said, "This is terrible. This is ridiculous. Can't do that. Because, number one, Pharaoh's decree, we don't know if it'll actually happen. I mean, it's a decree, but maybe it'll be successful, maybe it won't. Yours will definitely be successful." Right? It's a law of science. If you don't live together, you won't have children. Second of all, Pharaoh's decree at the end of the day, even if it's partially successful, will only affect the boys, whereas your decree will affect the boys and the girls, and you're effectively making a decree that's harsher than Pharaoh's, that will bring the Jewish nation to an end. And Amram said, "You're right." So he remarried Yocheved. It's a whole story in the Talmud. They actually had a chuppah. Miriam danced in front of them. It's a whole story the way the Talmud describes it. And because Amram did that, everyone else did that as well. As a result of that, Moses was born. So in that story, this is something Rabbi Sacks points out in his book, in that story, who had the authority? Amram. But in that story, who had the better leadership? A little girl called Miriam. Took initiative, spoke up, felt responsible. It wasn't her problem, and we're going to talk about it in a minute. That's part of leadership, that we don't just sit back and say, it's not my problem. It is my problem. The strategy is a different story, how we go about it, but leadership is that I take initiative. I can inspire. If I can help, if I can have an effect, a positive effect, I need to do that. And in that case, the leadership was shown by a little girl, literally a little girl, called Miriam. And as a result, Moses was born, and Moses took the entire Jewish nation, led them out of Egypt towards the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, and so on and so forth. So I just want to tell you a little story that Rabbi Sacks tells, a famous story that Rabbi Sacks tells, and he's spoken about it many, many times, but he speaks about it in this book as well. And I want to share it with you before we sort of go on to the first concept of leadership. So he tells a story, and he's a very, very inspiring individual, and I'm sure many of you have written or heard many of what he has to say, and much of what he's written. And he is a true leader in the true sense of the word. But he tells the story how he came to pursue leadership. Because I don't know if all of you are aware, Rabbi Sacks, who has had such a strong impact on the Jewish nation, really, in many, many different ways, had no intention of becoming a rabbi. Absolutely no intention. In 1967, he was and he writes this in the introduction of this book as well, he was a philosophy student. He was studying philosophy in England. It was a time, an interesting time, it was just after the Six-Day War. And he said at that time it was taken for granted, in Britain at least, that being a philosopher had to mean you were an atheist, because many philosophers were atheists, or at least an agnostic. And he wanted to know how Jewish thinkers, there was kind of an inspiration at the time, again, surrounding the Six-Day War, was a miraculous event, and everyone was affected. So he wanted to know how Jewish thinkers are responding to that concept and the challenges of the time. So he didn't see so many thinkers in England at the time, so he decided to travel to America. And in America, he had heard of lots of great rabbis and great thinkers, and he singles out two. He said he wanted to make a point of meeting Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the head of the YU, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he says each meeting that he had a profound effect on it, but the one he tells in the book was the meeting he had with the Rebbe, with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he tells the story in a funny way. He said that he rocked up one day at the Rebbe's headquarters, and he thought it was simple. He approaches someone there, an important-looking rabbi, and he says he'd like to make an appointment with the Rebbe. And the guy starts to laugh. He says, "You can't just make an appointment with the Rebbe. The Rebbe doesn't see that many people and doesn't see people every day. And it's not going to happen." So he says, he was naive, very, very naive. And he said, "Look, I'm traveling. In a few days, I'll be in California. Here's my number. If an appointment becomes available, call me." And kind of thing. To his surprise, 4 weeks later, he got a call. On a Sunday night, and he was told that the Rebbe could see him for a few minutes on Thursday night. So he didn't have money for air tickets. Amazing thing. It's not relevant to the discussion, but just a nice detail of the story. He didn't have money at the time for anything. So he took a Greyhound bus from the West Coast to the East Coast. I mean, it takes days, and arrived in time on Thursday date, sometime during the day, in time for his appointment. Anyway, he describes the meeting. And they were talking, and he had come to see what Jewish thinkers think. And in all these meetings, that's what he did. He started off by asking questions, and he got their insights, and he was doing that. And then he said, suddenly, in the middle of the meeting, there was a role reversal. The Rebbe said, "Now can I ask you a few questions?" And he wasn't expecting that. And he said, "Tell me, how many Jewish students are there at Cambridge University? How many of them are engaged in Jewish life? How many of them ever go to synagogue?" Whatever, you know, that kind of thing, and so on and so forth. And he gave the Rebbe the answers. He wasn't expected to be interviewed. He had come to interview the Rebbe, but he said only about 10%. There was a very low level of engagement at the time. And the Rebbe said, "So what are you doing about it?" So he said, "Nothing. I'm a philosophy student." And he started to explain to the Rebbe why he can't really do anything about it. And he started with the famous sentence that he always says. He said, "In the situation in which I find myself," and he was about to finish the sentence when the Rebbe interrupted him. And the Rebbe didn't let him go further, and he said, "You do not find yourself in a situation, you put yourself in a situation, and therefore, because you put yourself in one situation, you can then choose to put yourself in another situation. And therefore, what do you mean you're not doing anything about it? In the situation in which you find yourself, so you're not positioned to do anything about having a positive impact on Jewish life at Cambridge University, but you can choose to do something else, and you can choose to have leadership." And that was the turning point in his life, and eventually, because of that, he actually pursued a whole different path. He did get a degree in philosophy later. I didn't say it in the book, but I've heard him speak once that he was actually going to pursue a degree in philosophy and in law, and he actually ended up getting both after he became a rabbi. And so he became a rabbi and a person has a law degree and a philosophy doctorate. So, and eventually he went on and became a rabbi and then became chief rabbi. And he said that was a turning point in his life, because leadership is a choice. And everyone can be a leader in a different context, in a different way. Everyone has a sphere of influence, and no one has the luxury to say, in the situation in which I find myself, I can't have an impact. Because you don't find yourself in a situation. You find yourself... Just to clarify that statement, because it kind of seems to contradict a lot of the things we've often said. Yeah, you don't choose the geographical situation you're gonna be in, or you don't choose the circumstances which you're gonna be in, but you choose your response. And I think that's what the Rebbe was saying. In other words, you don't find yourself in a situation and say, well, the situation dictates to me how I can respond and how I can't. You can choose to respond differently and therefore choose to place yourself in a different situation. Maybe you can't choose a different set of events, maybe you can't choose a different geographical position, but you can certainly choose how you respond. Okay, so taking that a step further, I want to spend the rest of today sort of talking about what is the first ingredient to accessing the leadership within ourselves. So we've touched upon it in the last half an hour, but just now to develop it a bit. And to understand that leadership, and I'm talking about leadership on all levels, for all of us, leadership has many, many ingredients. But the first ingredient is the choice of leadership, meaning the willingness to feel responsible. Now, I don't mean feeling responsible in a heavy sense, because that's the worst thing a person could do is to carry the load of the world on our shoulders. We can't. We've got to let God run the world. But feeling responsible, meaning feeling that I have a role to play. Because we know that at the very beginning of the Torah, we read stories. In fact, we read three stories at the very, very beginning, before we get to Abraham, who was a leader. But before we get to Abraham, we read three stories of failed leadership, meaning failed responsibility and people who didn't want to take responsibility. The first, of course, is one we've mentioned many, many times. It's personal responsibility. It's the concept of Adam and Eve, who, when confronted with transgressing the command that God had just given them when they were created, they both didn't take responsibility. Adam blamed Eve and Eve blamed the snake, right? And that was like the ultimate of not taking responsibility. And I think I've mentioned this previous times, that when you fast forward hundreds and hundreds of years, centuries and centuries, when you get to King David, which became the ultimate leader we just mentioned before, one of the things about King David was the incredible willingness to take responsibility. Responsibility for himself and responsibility, therefore, for others, because it goes together. It's one ability, it's one mindset, the mindset of taking responsibility. Because we know with King David, there's the famous story of him and Bathsheba and his apparent sin and how you interpret that and so on and so forth. But whatever, even on his level, and the Talmud says it wasn't the transgression the way we understand it and so on, but even on his level, God was upset with him. And yet when God confronted him, he remained the leader, he remained King David, he remained a righteous person, and God forgave him. And yet with Adam and Eve, who did something apparently not as severe, they ate a forbidden fruit, God never forgave them. Why? The difference is responsibility. Because when God confronted Adam and confronted Eve, they didn't take responsibility, they blamed something else. I can't do anything about it, right? And that's the first failure in leadership as well. I can't do anything about it. And in their case, it was personal. I can't do anything about it because you gave me a wife who gave me the fruit. I can't do anything about it because the serpent, the snake, convinced me, right? Whereas when God confronted, wasn't God, it was God's prophet, Natan HaNavi, came to King David and confronted him with his failing, the first word that King David said was, Chatati, I have sinned. I take responsibility. And I'm going to fix it. I'm going to do tshuva. I'm going to repent. I'm going to reconnect. And God forgave him. Because when you take responsibility, that does it all. You got to go through a process. But the first ingredient is taking responsibility. So that was on a personal level. The second story we read, which is an interesting one, not as well known, is the story of Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel. When Cain, the first sibling rivalry, and unfortunately the first murder, which didn't take very long to happen in society, but it happened. So when God confronts Cain with the murder of his brother, he says the following, he says, where's your brother? He says the famous, famous words, am I my brother's keeper? Right? Now, if you look carefully at what transpired there, that sentence, am I my brother's keeper, was actually not a denial of what happened. Because Cain took responsibility on that level. In other words, he took responsibility. He says, yes, it was me. He didn't deny it. He didn't tell God it wasn't me. I did kill him. But on a deeper level, what he was saying is, and so what? He refused to take any moral responsibility. What he was saying is, that I am a creation, you've created me, my primary focus is taking care of myself, and I do not have a moral responsibility to anyone else. If we live our life under a complete Darwinian philosophy where the fittest survive, that's what Cain was saying. It's the message of Cain which reverberates throughout history. Where people say, my primary concern is about myself. And because my primary concern is about myself, I have no moral responsibility to others. I might have killed him, but so what? I did it for my benefit. I don't have... Today, I mean, obviously, when it comes to murder, that's abhorrent to us, because how can you do that? You can't kill someone else for your own benefit. But we still do it in other levels. We will hurt someone, or we'll refrain from helping someone. Because why should I? Who said, why should I get involved? Why should I take that moral responsibility? So that story was that story of Cain not taking responsibility. Now, let's contrast this with a good leadership story. Let's go back to Moses. Moses had a comfortable life when he was born, right? Just to go back to the story. Moses was put in, he was born, and he was born prematurely, and then his mother was worried that they would discover him and throw him into the river. So the famous story, she placed him in a basket on the River Nile. And he got found and discovered by Batya. Batya was the daughter of Pharaoh. A whole story, she tried to nurse him, he would nurse. Miriam found a Jewish nurse, and anyway, he was given back when he was 2 years old, and he grew up essentially in Pharaoh's palace. The plight of the Jewish nation had nothing to do with him. First of all, he was from the tribe of Levi. And in Egypt, all the tribes actually were enslaved, but actually the tribe of Levi wasn't. That's the one tribe that actually were not slaves in Egypt. But even within the tribe of Levi, Moses was a different category altogether. He grew up in Pharaoh's palace. He had the luxury of being in Pharaoh's palace. Pharaoh took care of him. There's a whole story. One time he almost killed him because he took he wanted to take the crown of Pharaoh. But whatever it is, bottom line, he survived and he was living a very good life. Then when he grows up, it says, the Chumash tells us a beautiful story. He walks out into the street and he sees his brethren suffering. And then he sees Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian taskmaster, hitting a Jew, hitting a slave, one of the slaves, beating him up. And Moses kills the Egyptian to save the victim. But the wording in the Chumash is unbelievable. The Chumash tells us that when he did that, he looked around. Moses looks around. Vayar ki ein ish, and he sees there's no one around. And so he kills it. Now, the simple reading of that is, because you know, everything we learn in Torah has many levels, you can interpret many, many ways. The simple reading is, he looked around to see no one was looking. So he was safe, and therefore he saved the victim, he saved the slave, he saved the Jew by killing the Egyptian. But some commentaries ask, what do you mean no one was around? It was the middle of, they were working, they were slaves. It was a building site. There were plenty of people around. Now we know that some people were around because the next day he realized he got discovered. Because he saw two Jews fighting and he told them to stop, and the one guy had a bit of chutzpah. He said to Moses, what are you going to go and tell him? You're going to kill me now like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? And Moses says, oh yeah, I'm in trouble. And he had to flee. Eventually he had to flee. Right? So one interpretation of this verse, he looked around and he saw that no one was around. Not that he saw no one was around physically. He looked around and saw no one is coming to help. No one is taking responsibility. No one thinks it's their problem. And no one is doing anything about it. And he says he's got to do something about it. Now in modern literature, just to show you how this works, it's an amazing thing. I'm sure some of you know this, but I just want to show you a short video clip, because in modern literature it's called the bystanders effect. Right? Where people who are passive follow what everyone else is doing and don't get involved even when it's morally right or morally responsible to get involved. And this has happened in many, many different things. Let's just watch a little short, just in case you haven't seen this, watch a short clip.
Place like this street in New York City, if you were unfortunate enough to be the victim of a crime or taken ill unexpectedly, you might think that surrounded by all these people, someone would intervene. After all, isn't there safety in numbers? Psychologists say no. Research suggests that often a victim is less likely to receive assistance when surrounded by a group rather than a single bystander. When people are in a crowd, it's easier to pass the buck. It's what psychologists call the diffusion of responsibility. Liverpool Street Station in London, a busy thoroughfare for commuters. Unknown to these passers-by, Peter is an actor. As part of an experiment on bystander apathy, he's pretending to be ill. How long before he gets help? Helping would be inconvenient or even risky. He lies there for more than 20 minutes and no one raises an eyebrow.
It's always very distressing to watch situations like this where people are obviously suffering and no one's actually helping them. But what we have here is two conflicting rules. One is the rule we ought to help, and the other is the rule that we ought to do what everybody else is doing. And here you have a group of strangers who are exerting the pressure not to intervene, not to help. And it's very difficult to rebel.
Ruth, another actor, takes Peter's place. How long before she receives help? Four minutes later, and 34 people have passed without stopping.
Well, people don't really want to know. They just haven't got the time. Well, they have got the time, they just don't want to be involved.
Unwittingly, these strangers have silently formed a temporary group with a rule: don't get involved. They're afraid to stand out from the crowd and won't take action if no one else does. This woman has clearly spotted Ruth, but she conforms to the rule and does nothing. Watch what happens, though, when someone else helps. She suddenly finds herself in a different group with a new rule to help.
First I thought she was dead. Then I saw to check to see if she was breathing or not. And I looked around and I could believe that no one had noticed her because there was a bloke sat there just absorbed in reading a newspaper.
This time Peter's dressed as a respectable gentleman. Now that his dress is in keeping with those around him, how long before he's rescued?
How are you today?
6 seconds. She even calls him sir, and suddenly everyone's a good Samaritan.
Do you suffer from epilepsy?
No.
Why are you lying on the floor in the rain?
Because he's part of the right group. Everyone wants to help.
I was just aching to be in his position of feeling ill, and nobody helped him walking past, so I just like to check that he was okay. And I thought, well, it's wet, so he must really be ill. He's going to ruin the suit anyway.
Can I say another little quick, this is a very short one. Again? Ah, this is in a school, I think it was done. Okay. There is a very, very famous story. I don't know how you pronounce her name, but it was in 1964. There was a woman who was killed. Her name was Kitty Gonovas or something. And she was the whole thing. She worked in a bar and she came back late in the morning. And they figured she was murdered. She was beaten up, and then the guy left and came back and finished off the job. And what they found was, by looking around the buildings and the lights going on and doing after research, that there were 38 of her neighbors who actually saw it happen. Right? There was, and no one called the police. They've done some studies of this in schools where they also set up actors and stuff, and the same sort of thing happens. So It's quite a shocking thing, but it comes from this concept of apathy, and it comes from this idea of following the group. I don't want to get involved if no one else is getting. I don't want to step up if no one else. And that's what Moses is saying. Vayar, he looks around and he says, "Ke'ein lish," there's no one doing anything. So he could have, he of all people didn't have to do anything, because he was going back to the palace. He was fine. And that was the beginning of his leadership. The beginning of his leadership was that no, he says, no one is doing anything. I need to do something, even if it's a risk to his own life. He did it because taking responsibility. The first couple of stories in the Torah is about people who don't take responsibility, and therefore they weren't leaders. But he was prepared to take responsibility, which sowed the seeds for his ultimate leadership. Which of course extends to the very famous story of lack of leadership that we mentioned very briefly before, which is the next parsha in the Torah, the story of Noah. Right? Now, as I said before, Noah is someone who was righteous. Noah was called a righteous person. Right? He was a good person. But he had no influence. Now, what happened was with Noah, and the Zohar points out very, very clearly. The Zohar points out that Noah was someone who could have had a tremendous influence. It was a corrupt generation. Noah chose, which sometimes that's a choice, a legitimate choice. He chose to spiritually protect himself and his family by secluding himself and remaining completely separate to outside influences. Now that's not such a simple concept, because we are taught that the influence, peer pressure is a tremendous thing. Influence of friends is an amazing thing. We pray every day that God should grant us a good neighbor and a good friend and all these kind of things, because we are influenced by our social group. We are influenced by people around us. And therefore, to live in an environment which is negative is difficult, and it's hard to survive psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, and so on and so forth. So Noah takes the choice, takes the path of completely setting himself away. But then God appears to Noah, and that's what we read in the Torah, and he tells him, I'm going to bring a flood, I'm going to destroy the generation, but I'm going to save you because you're righteous. And he tells him to build this ark, which took an amazingly long time to build. We're talking about ancient times. And Rashi, one of the commentators, points out, why did God, if God was going to bring a flood and God was going to miraculously save Noah, because the story of the Teva is not just a good ship, it was a miracle. All the animals were in there and he survived for a year. So many details of the story are completely miraculous. If God wanted to miraculously save Noah, so why don't you just miraculously save him? Why did he bother him with building this huge ark that took so many years to build, decades to build, right? And the answer is given is because God was trying to tell Noah something. He was trying to tell him, here's your chance. I'm not going to destroy the generation just yet. They deserve destruction, but I'm going to give them a chance, because I want you to go into the middle of the square and build this huge, monstrous building, to which everyone will ask you why you're building it, and you'll have the chance of influencing. You'll have the chance to lead. You'll have the chance to go out and try and bring people back. Try and bring people to improve. And Noah didn't. He didn't do that. And that's why there's a famous Hasidic expression, a Yiddish expression, which I know I've shared with you before, but it's a beautiful idea. It's called, we always call Noah, he was a righteous person, but in Yiddish it's called a tzaddik in pelts, which means a tzaddik in a fur coat. What does that mean? We say that when it's very cold, there's two ways to warm up. Either you can put on a fur coat or you can light a fire. The difference is, when you put on a fur coat, you become warm, everyone else remains cold. When you light a fire, everyone becomes warm. Right? And that's what Noach didn't do. Abraham Avinu, the first founder of the Jewish nation, so to speak, was completely different. He fought the whole generation. He struggled against the stream just to bring people to values, just to bring people to monotheism and living a life of morals and values. He didn't have to do that. God wasn't threatening to destroy anyone, but he took that initiative, because he says, if I'm here and I've had the good fortune of having a level of recognition in the existence of God, in moral living and so on and so forth, and I look around and I see no one else has, I need to do something about it. It's a mindset. It's an attitude. Now, I want to just clarify that when we talk about this mindset and attitude, we're not talking about strategy. Strategy is a different story. We'll talk about strategy over the next few weeks, because everyone has a different strategy and every situation calls for a different strategy. Not every time you speak up, you need to do it in an effective way. We know that the Talmud tells us that when you reprimand someone else or you guide someone else, just as it's a mitzvah to say something that will be well received, it's a mitzvah to refrain from saying things that won't be well received. Right? So the strategy obviously has to be carefully thought out. What's going to be the effective strategy? What's the best way of inspiring others? What's the best way of speaking up? What's the best way to lead? What's the best way to light the fire so everyone else becomes warm? That's the issue of strategy. But before the strategy is the mindset. And the mindset is that you cannot just look sit back and say, it's not my problem. Because it is our problem. We have a responsibility to other people. When we come across something, when we are involved in something, it is our responsibility. What we do about it, every situation calls for a different strategy. But the mindset is that what we do about it, because silence is to agree with what's happening. There's a famous story coming up, you know, soon, this coming week, we're going to begin the 3 weeks of mourning leading up to Tisha B'Av, which was the destruction of the temple. And one of the tragic stories about surrounding the destruction of the temple is a story of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. It's a whole story in the Talmud of how Jerusalem was destroyed, and essentially it had to do with a person who had a friend and an enemy, and he got mixed up, and the enemy was invited to the banquet instead of the friend, and the host embarrassed him. And there were a lot of leaders, there were a lot of Torah scholars there and leaders, and they were sitting there. And he tried to plead not to be embarrassed, he'll pay for the whole meal, and he just let him stay, just not to, right? And the guy kicked him out. And as a result, he went to the Roman emperor and said negative things about the Jewish people, and that led to the destruction of Jerusalem. But the very hurting, the very painful line that's in the Talmud is that when this guy was thrown out of the house, he thought to himself, he said, you know, there were some leaders sitting there, or supposed leaders. And he said, "Midshatki Rabbanan," because the rabbis sitting there were quiet, it's a sign that they agreed with what was happening. All I needed then was to protest. It might not even worked, but I wanted to see that they got involved, and they didn't. Not always getting involved works. Not always getting involved can work, but you've got to at least show. And they kept quiet. And I want to just share with you an amazing thing which I once read, and I went looking for it, and thank God found it. I remember reading it it's based on one of the on the writings of the Chida, who was a Sephardic sage of the 18th century. And I found this concept written in an article by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. And it surrounds a story in Chumash, a very, very cryptic medrash. And I wanted to share with you because it's an amazing, amazing insight. There's a story in the Chumash that Aaron, the high priest, had two sons, Nadav and Avihu. He had four sons, but the two first sons, Nadav, were great people, but they died. They died prematurely. Why? Because it says a whole story in Parashat Shmini that they walked into the temple when the Mishkan was erected, when the tabernacle was erected. They went inside to an area that they weren't allowed to go to. They brought a foreign fire that they weren't commanded to bring, and a fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and they passed away. So the Talmud says, why do they deserve? There's many different explanations of why they were guilty of such a punishment. So it says in the Talmud that it once happened that Moses and Aaron were walking down the road, and Nadav and Avihu were walking behind them. And Nadav turned to Avihu, right? The older brother turned to the younger brother. And he made a comment. He said, you know, when are these old guys going to pass away ready so we can take over? Right? So God said, okay, we'll see who outlives who. In other words, so that was a terrible thing against Moshe and Aaron. So they passed away. All right, so that's the story. Now in Tanakh, there's a famous individual called Iov, Job. Right? Job was a famous person. He experienced a lot of suffering. It's a lot of commentary about who exactly Iov was and why he had to suffer so much and so on and so forth. But there's a very cryptic medrash. And the cryptic medrash says that sometimes we have a medrash that is very cryptic. We have to go to the commentary to find out what does it mean? How do you decode this medrash? And the cryptic medrash says the following, that when Iov heard about the death of the two sons of Aaron, he was seized with tremendous fear. And he knew he was in trouble, and his fear was not unfounded because he did end up suffering. So it's a very strange medrash. What does Iov's life story, his suffering, have to do with the two sons of Aaron, right? And why, when he heard about the story of Nadav and Avihu, why was he overcome with a sudden fear. What happened? So the Chidar, Rabbi Yosef David Azulay of the 18th century, was an Italian Sephardic sage, a mystic. He says the following. He says, in order to understand this, you've got to go to a third part of the Talmud. And the third part of the Talmud tells us the following, that Pharaoh in Egypt, before he enslaved the Jewish people, he had three advisors. One was Bilam, who we read in this week's Parsha, the prophet, the non-Jewish prophet who tried to annihilate the Jewish people by cursing them in this week's portion. Yitro, who later became Moses' father-in-law, and Eov. There were three advisors. And as the Jewish people in Egypt were multiplying and becoming more powerful and Paro was becoming threatened, he called a meeting with these three advisors. This is what the Talmud says. The Medrash tells us. And he asked them what to do. Bilam said, you got to fight them. You got to try and destroy them. You got to undermine them. You got to just go for it. Right? Just do whatever you can. Eov remained silent. And Yitro fought Pharaoh. He says, no, they're good people. Don't be threatened. They're okay. Treat them well. Bilam was rewarded with Pharaoh. But eventually, Bilam was killed. When the whole story of this week's parasha, when he tried to destroy the Jewish people, a war afterwards broke out between the Jewish people and Midian, and Bilam was killed. Why was he killed? As a punishment for what he did to Pharaoh by encouraging Pharaoh to enslave the Jewish people. Yitro, who fought Pharaoh, was rewarded that eventually he became the father-in-law of Moses. His whole family became part of the Jewish nation and his descendants were rewarded, the whole story. What happened to Eov? Eov eventually ended up suffering. Now, what was the story with Eov? What was going through Eov's mind? Eov was actually a righteous person. Eov was a good man. He didn't want Pharaoh to persecute the Jewish people. But he was also practical. So in Eov's mind, he certainly wasn't going to say what Bilam was going to say. He wasn't going to encourage Pharaoh to persecute the Jewish people. But he wasn't going to be as crazy as Yitro to start fighting with Pharaoh. You don't fight with a dictator. You don't fight with a powerful dictator like that. You don't contradict a powerful dictator. And therefore, in Eov's mind, he was the pragmatist. He was the practical guy. And Yitro was the nut. Until he heard the story of Nadav and Avihu. Why? He hears a story that Nadav and Avihu were killed by God. He researches the story. And he hears that one day Nadav and Avihu were walking behind Moses and Aaron, and Nadav turns to Avihu and he says, when are these people going to die so we can take over? So Nadav said a really disparaging thing, and God punishes them both. And Eov thinks to himself, hold on a second. Nadav, understand. Nadav was the person who said the disparaging remark about Moses and Aaron, but Avihu didn't do anything. And he suddenly realizes, no, Avihu did. He was silent. He didn't say anything. He didn't comment. He didn't say, that wasn't a nice thing to say. He didn't try and reach out to his brother. And Eov suddenly realizes that Nadav and Avihu were both punished because Nadav was punished for what he said. Avihu was punished for being silent. And Eov realizes that silence makes you part of the crime. And therefore he was seized by fear. He says, back in Mitzrayim, back in Egypt, I was silent. I didn't get involved. I stood by. I'm scared. And he had what to be scared about. So just an amazing insight that remaining silent is not just an easy option. Remaining silent makes us complicit. So therefore, when we talk about, on a simpler level, in terms of our responsibility to those around us, whatever the strategy might be, but we have it within us and we have a responsibility within us that we can inspire others. We can make a difference to our family, to friends, to whatever it is. What we cannot do is not take responsibility for that ability. We cannot remain silent. If we see things happening around us that need something to happen, we cannot just have the bystander's affair. We cannot say, well, no one else is doing something. I'm not going to do anything. Why get involved? Now, obviously, we need to get involved with the right motives and the right reasons and the right strategies and so on. It has to be effective. But the mindset has to be, I'm a little guy, but I can make a difference because we all have leadership within us. And therefore, in summary, leadership is not about authority. Leadership is not about power. It's not about a position. It's about an attitude which we can all have within our circle of influence. And the very, very first ingredient is to have that mindset that I need to stand, I need to take initiative. I am responsible. I can have an influence. I can affect others. How we do that? What are the strategies? What are the tools? That's what we're going to try and develop over the next few weeks. Have a great week.